back to the Game Grooves Uncovered podcast. Thank you all for listening. We've been getting a lot of really cool requests to talk to people, and today is no different. We've got a special guest, friend of mine, Daniel Dockery. You may know him from his Twitter, where he's been able to share a lot of really cool thoughts on fandoms, franchises, video games, movies. You may also have seen some of his work because he's written for a lot of really cool sites, talking Crunchyroll, Polygon, Wired, Vulture, and more. And obviously, he's a humongous fan of a lot of our favorite games and franchises, including, but not limited to, Pokemon. So, upcoming, by the time you hear this, you may already be able to check out his brand new book, Monster Kids, which talks all about Pokemon. I've had the chance to talk a little bit about the book as it was being written and check out a panel at MAGFest done by Daniel himself. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is a really cool chance to talk to someone who's not a composer on a kind of music-ish podcast, but you know, everyone listening to this is just a huge gamer half the time. And there's so many angles to what goes into not just making games, but, you know, enjoying them, discussing them, and growing with them. So I really wanted to see if I could find a way to, like, steer a conversation with you where we could just talk about what it's like to make the book, to kind of have a job that you do, you know, investigating fandoms and stuff. So I wanted to start, I guess, with an easy one. It's just like, what is it about Pokemon that you like when people, like, come up to you and have no idea in 2022, like, what's keeping you there on such a deep level to where you'd write a book?
I think, some of the things in Pokemon have kind of passed me by, like arguments, I'd like them to be good games that I generally enjoy, but a lot of, like, the arguments about whether they're, like, difficulty or even, you know, stuff like open world versus, you know, more strict routes, it's kind of, like, passes me by. Sure. I'm much more interested in 2022 in Pokemon as kind of a cultural phenomenon and how it's kind of grown, how that has kind of grown and evolved, for lack of a better term, over time. Pokemon, you know, as this weird watershed moment, right, of video games and anime and broad general culture, is really, really fascinating to me. And that kind of keeps me going, you know, coming up on, or yeah, at this point, mm-hmm, over 24 years after I first discovered it. So.
Yeah, actually, I mean, to everybody listening who's played Pokemon or watched the show, or, you know, one key point you said is it's not just, you know, red and blue anymore, or
even
the game franchise. It's like it's a thought process.
It's huge. It's a it's at this point, it's a lifestyle brand. I'm not joking. It's infiltrated and kind of saturated every, like, you can, for lack of a better phrase, you can find it in every aisle in Target.
That's a really nice and way to put it.
It's everywhere. It is. It's huge. It's, you know, it's, I don't know. You don't get to be the most, you know, the highest grossing media franchise in history without filling in every possible crack of societal awareness.
Sure. And, like, you know, before I completely dive into the book, one of the first questions I thought was, like, in your research, did you find other historical, like, franchises in either the United States, Japan, or in general that reflect any semblance of Pokemania? You know, like, were people really that crazy about James Bond or Godzilla or even, you know, comic books? Like, was there something like that before?
The suffix mania has been attached to a few cultural trends over the years, right, that are really exciting. Like, you mentioned James Bond, that was, like, the Bond mania. In fact, in the 60s, I think it was the old Batman actor Adam West said there were the three B's. There was Bond, Beatles, and Batman. And they all, obviously, you've heard of Beatlemania, which was, you know, huge, and Bond Mania, which was, you know, not quite as big, but still pretty huge. Batmania, which kind of in the span of a year, all of a sudden, the entire semblance of a comic book character got redefined. And there's the second Batmania in 1989 when they were releasing the original film with Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton. And, you know, Warner Brothers went on this 6-month scorched earth campaign where you couldn't miss that bat symbol there. It became ubiquitous. It became ubiquitous. Like it ceased to be a movie and became an event. And that's kind of what Pokemon did as well, is where it ceased to be just an anime or just a trading card game or just a, you know, amalgamation of a bunch of different mediums. It became kind of a touchstone event for millennials. Everyone I know, even if they weren't into Pokemon, remember kind of what it was like to all of a sudden have Pokemon hit the States and be like, oh, wow, okay, I guess everyone in the world is into this now. Cool.
Yeah, it's very, I like how you say the target aisle thing, because one of the things I think of whenever I go back to that age, and I'm sure you might have lived through this too, is just mass commercialization of a brand because it's so darn exciting. And, you know, whether that's good or bad is a separate conversation, but Star Wars Episode One for me also kind of had this contained moment, whereas Pokemon, of course, like, it lived on into all these different ways. And obviously Star Wars is a franchise, but the fact I could go to Taco Bell and they had limited collectible cups of Sebulba and Anakin, all these like one-offs from this one movie that ended up being kind of critically panned. You know, it's very fascinating. Whereas with Pokemon, obviously it lives to this day. And now, you know, you could go buy a pack of oranges and there'll be like, you know, some brand stuck to it. Pokemon, you could have a backpack, a t-shirt, you know, airplanes with monikers. So it really does warrant a book.
No, it did. And
compendium.
Yeah. I touch on this in the book, but, you know, they came out in the same year, Episode One and Pokemon. And, you know, they're interesting companion pieces. If we can get into this for like a little bit.
Yeah.
Or just for a second. I don't want to take up too much time with this, you know, just the rantings of, you know, into the millennium pop culture. But it's, you know, there are two very, very cool things to look at, because on one hand, you had Episode One, which is kind of, you know, built inherently around the fame of a franchise from about 20 years earlier. It's attached to that, you know, narratively and symbolically. It touched a lot of the same things that Pokemon had: massive merchandise mover, all the fast food tie-ins. But Pokemon was kind of its number one rival in that year, because also Episode One, it's very toyetic, and a lot of the attempts by all of its licensors and by the movie itself was like, okay, we're introducing a new generation to Star Wars. And Star Wars, which, you know, a thing that had kind of been fathered in by the previous generation of, you know, parents who had seen Star Wars were now taking care of the kids that seen Star Wars. But on the other hand, you had Pokemon, which did not have this legacy status. And one of the reasons that kids grew so attached to Pokemon at the time, and why Pokemon kind of ate the lunch of every other established franchise going on at the time, is that kids were the master of it. They were the immediate experts. Usually as a child, you're kind of limited by what your parents give you, you know, the availability of, you know, if your parents don't like Batman, they're not going to take you to go see Batman movies or whatever. But Pokemon, parents didn't know what it was. They, you know, teachers didn't know what it was. Pundits didn't know what it was. Preachers didn't know what it was. No one knew quite what Pokemon was, except for kids. And kids immediately knew everything about it. And there's a lot of power in that. There's a kind of intangible status to that when you're a child and you realize that, oh, I'm the teacher in this. I hold, you know, this is my, you teach me and I'll teach you moment, not the other way around. So there's something very cool about that. And I think it empowered a lot of kids, especially kids on the verge of, you know, kind of the internet is becoming more used by more people around right. that time. Anime is getting seen more. Video games are going strong, but we're on the cusp of this kind of like video games as art argument that's going to be one of the defining cultural arguments of the aughts. And so much stuff is happening about this, and so much stuff that this new generation of kids are going to be at the forefront of. And there's a lot of, you know, Pokemon is one of those big pillars of that new cultural wave of all of a sudden it redefines who can be experts of things.
Yeah, so. The ownership of like the fandom that resonates so strongly with me because, of course, my folks came from India, so they had a lot of British influence. So everything that trickled down would only fall into that subset. So as a result, I didn't grow up with comics. I got into them 6-7 years ago. I didn't grow up with so much. But with Pokemon, I was explaining these complicated concepts to, you know, my parents who had never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is uniquely owned when everything else around you isn't. So, you know,
There's no like Siskel and Ebert of Pokemon at the time. There wasn't like, okay, well, these guys obviously know more than everyone. You know, there's like the kid, like there was a kid named Trevor in elementary school who's, you know, like uncle worked at Nintendo or whatever. But other than that, all the other, oh, Trevor. But other than that, there was no like defined source of mentorship or authority in this. Kids were the authority in it. So. Yeah.
The abstraction that, and I don't want to go like too far into the future, and I certainly don't want to rant about Legends Arceus, but I want to discuss kind of, because Pokemon is something that even today, the grumpiest, frumpiest person probably around our age, who's still stuck in that Gen 1 area, probably still, you know, like a lot of people still love Pokemon as this concept. They, you know, like me, I loved new Pokemon Snap. I love these spinoffs and, you know, all of that is happening now, and I'm like struggling to keep up with things just because part of me wants to. But I wonder if you think, or you found, you know, through research, like a difference between how Pokemon is now and then, such that it was, you know, maybe more accessible back then, or if the fact that it was this magical new thing is what we really hold on to, and now it's established, it's as concrete as Marvel comics or Star Wars, or, you know, and maybe there's like less of that factor.
Well, Pokemon has always been a nostalgia brand, whether it is, you know, not that its only backbone is nostalgia, but it's always been, it's always had its core in nostalgia. Like it's all, you know, it's built upon the dream of a guy named Satoshi Tajiri, who invented Pokemon, who kind of had this vision of the world, this his hometown and the area around it kind of pre-urbanized or pre-industrialized or without all of the trademarks of heavy growth and population in an area. And it's a child's dream because, you know, man's nature is to destroy.
Sure.
it's a child's idea of kind of harmony between, or optimal harmony between, you know, there's obviously a lot of people that strive for this, and I applaud every single one of their efforts.
Sure.
it's this kind of like perfect harmony that can be achieved by a child, between nature and, you know, mankind's technological and industrial development. And so that's layered in Pokemon, you know, red, blue, green, yellow, through every game.
Yeah.
But now Pokemon, has also a very like corporate level of nostalgia where the people it's being introduced to, like Star Wars was in episode one, as we talked about, kids are being introduced through it through parents who knew what it was and enjoyed it earlier. So that changes the game a little bit in how it's like, and how it's, you know, focused, and how, you know, the amount, the broadening of the spectrum of people that can get into it. You know, it's especially because, you know, back then, we don't see the backlash to Pokemon was pretty heavy. If you go back and read reviews, the adult backlash to Pokemon was pretty heavy. The adult backlash to Pokemon was pretty heavy. Where if you read reviews of like the first movie or the first few movies or the games, it's like an arms race to see who can be the most mean to children's entertainment.
Which I do recall some of that.
It's a little messed up that you don't see that as much anymore now.
Mm-hmm.
Because now
nerd culture being more acceptable and people more vocal against, you know, that kind
I think. I think it's also like the people that are reviewing movies now were fans of Pokemon in the beginning, and they not only did they grow up with it, but they see what it's like. They see its place in the world, and they see kind of what it's doing, or what it's done. Whereas, you know, adults back in 1989, you know, we're dealing with this technological paranoia about the fact that, you know, it's going to turn the year 2000 and all the computers are going to turn off,
sure,
or whatever, you know, or like, you know, a lot of people forget it's like the same year as Columbine,
right? Yes,
which was like this the last, or not the last, God, I wish it was the last.
Sure.
But it was in a string of like school shootings that slowly got more and more attached to like what media the kids were engaging in. And as soon as they figured out that they're playing Doom, or like in Mortal Kombat had like kicked off the Mortal Kombat and Doom, it kind of kicked off this 90s fear mongering about the fact that like all these violent video games are going to make kids want to karate chop each other's heads off or whatever.
Right.
And you know, you had that, you were still coming off like the 80s and early 90s, in which there was this massive fear that Japan was going to eat our economy alive.
Right, right, right.
And so you're dealing with all these like weird societal factors that, again, didn't really turn out to be, all these fears that didn't turn out to be super founded. But now that Pokemon has become, you know, a pillar of modern nerd and pop culture itself, you don't have that anymore. I'd argue that Pokemon is probably more accessible now because of that, because of the allowance of multiple generations to be into it with no real, like, why are you letting your kids watch that? Why do you, you know, is this, these Pikachus are going to give your kids ADHD? Whoa. Like that kind of thing. That kind of
perspective shift is really nice.
Yeah, and I'd argue that it's more accessible now. Like I remember, you know, when Pokemon Go came out the summer of 2016, where you'd have like videos of like people leaving their cars in New York City to run into Central Park to catch a Vaporeon.
Yes,
you know, it was madness. It looked like a scene from War of the Worlds.
It was a craze. And you know, even people like, you know, me, who had distanced themselves from like the mainline games for a little bit, right back in.
All these adults who like kind of knew what a Charmander was from back in 1989 were like showing me what they caught that day. And I was like, I had no idea that you were ever into Pokemon, you know? But
that
it was too. it was so ingrained in like our, you know, this kind of like millennial experience that we're like, that Pokemon is passing on, and that, you know, people are also passing on, and now the creators of Pokemon were fans of it as kids, you know?
Yeah.
It's now become this like this, you know, thing that you can, that we pass on to our children while still also a lot of people are still fans themselves. So I think that it's probably more accessible now that we've removed this weird kind of block. Also, a lot of that has to do with like, as you talk about video games, but also like anime and anime related properties. Yes. Where, you know, people had this weird, like, cheap Japanese manufactured stuff, like the economy battles in the 80s. We had this idea that anime was inherently less than like Western cartoons. But now you don't meet another person.
It almost feels like the opposite.
That wasn't raised on Toonami.
Right.
You know?
It's a complete, like, it's a shift in thought and, you know, it opened up a lot of doors. And I do appreciate, you know, bringing back Pokemon is not Pokemon Red or Sword and Shield or Stadium. It's everything around.
It's not.
Now,
yeah, go ahead.
Sure. In the interest of time, I want to talk about Pokemon itself. This will be the last thing before we can talk specifics on the book, but I had to talk a little bit about the MAGFest panel that you put together, talking specific about the first Pokemon's designs, which I do think is, you know, after seeing how you discussed it, it really made me think about the brilliance of these Pokemon designs, the first 151, why today I could call my mom and show her 20 Pokemon from that, you know, that chain, and she could name them all having not touched the games in forever. Like, what kind of elements have you really still thought, like, make those first 151 Pokemon so special, especially when those are the ones, you know, designed to kick off what would end up being such a phenomenon?
I think I talked, I talked about this a little bit in the panel, but and I don't remember the exact four pillars, but the two that I remember is that from the very beginning, you can see what the design is going to do, but the design, and you can see like what makes it relative to like a real life thing and what kind of differentiates it enough to be like a monster.
Mm.
But they also are ambiguous enough that you're not, that you don't know what their character is, so that if you see it, you're not like, oh, that's a happy Pokemon. Oh, that's a sad Pokemon. That's for the player to decide. And just like Pokemon being a source of like intense pride for knowing all the knowledge when your parents didn't, there's also this kind of like, there's a huge amount of just plain feeling cool when it comes to having a team of Pokemon. And you can decide, like, oh, that's my Lapras. He's kind of sad. Oh, yeah. That's my Charizard. He's pretty angry. That's my Pikachu. Always my boy. You know, like that kind of thing. And there's the first 151 all have that trait where you can say, okay, I know what that is. That's recognizable, but while still being fantastical. And I can also imbue it with, you know, whatever story or character arc or emotion that I want to give to it. And that's really important. That's really important for a good Pokemon design. I'd argue that a bad Pokemon design doesn't allow you to do that, whether it's too cluttered or doesn't have that, or is too like drawn with too many smiles or whatever. I'd argue that a Pokemon design that fails doesn't really have that. A Pokemon design that works is one that does. So
I like that. And it almost reminds me, you know, when you're a kid and you're playing with, you know, either action figures or dolls or things, a lot of the times that is kind of like how you played. And like with Pokemon, it felt no different. You know, you could have in the show, some jerk would have like a Raichu and he would just be like, you know, a complete horrible, you know, monster thing. And you'd be terrified. Yeah. And then the next thing you know, you see like a plush of it and you just want to like cuddle with it. Like,
yeah, they're Pokemon. They're emotions or whatever like you want them to be, and that's awesome. Especially because, you know, so many people define kind of monster or fantastical monsters as inherently like mean or at the very least hostile. Right. And to have 150 of them that, you know, they're whatever you want them to be is, you know, it reinvents the word. So.
Now, it's cool. It's cool to hear a lot of like your perspectives on these things, but I'm also curious in working on this book, you know, you mentioned talking to different people involved and I wanted to know, like, were there any standout kind of revelations talking to people from the inside, you know, of either, you know, the Pokemon anime or franchise as a whole game? Like, I'm not sure who all, of course, you were able to work, you know, to talk to and all, but. How was that?
No, it was good. It was, you know, I was glad to be able to reach out to people and also have people that talk to enough people that some of their friends who were kind of interview shy be like, this guy's cool.
Helpful.
which is great whenever you can as like a writer or a journalist or whatever. But I guess when it comes to like any big reveals, you know, I don't really want to spoil any like any of the sure. cool little details that you remember in the book, but I will say that like one of the things about it, and I write about this a little bit, is that usually when it comes to building franchises, it's usually built on one thing doing so well or going so well that another thing happens. Like for instance, you know, a Batman comic gets famous enough, and so they invent a TV serial or a movie serial, and that gets famous enough that they invent a toy line based off of it, or like that kind of thing. Usually it grows and grows and grows. But with Pokemon, because it had been gestating in Japan for a while, they had that package ready made for when it came over here. And obviously there was some stumbling blocks. The trading card game didn't come out as soon as they wanted it to in the States, but it would come out the next year, but they planned for it. There was a little bit of frustration.
As a kid, I didn't notice, but
as a kid, you don't notice those things because there's so much all at once that it just whoosh roller coasters your hair back.
Right.
But talking to everybody and kind of getting this idea of what it took to, you know, create this all encompassing franchise all at once was kind of cool because, you know, as a kid, I just couldn't grasp that. So that was probably mine. That was probably learning all the odds and ends to be able to put them together.
No, I like that. And it is really like when you're a kid and you're overwhelmed with all these different avenues with Pokemon, you could spend, you know, a whole book just on the anime.
Yeah, you could.
One area I wanted to see if you had either thoughts or were able to write about, of course, was Pokemon had a very unique musical identity.
Yes.
In the games, obviously, which came first, you know, you have a huge collection of scores all written by the same guy programming, if I'm not mistaken, Junichi Masuda, and you have you know, the battle themes all with like crazy scrambled 8-bit Game Boy music. You have Sweet Town themes, and all of those were also migrated to the anime, which then ended up having one of the most memorable theme songs of all time just for the American dub.
Yeah. If you've never heard the Japanese theme, it's pretty great as well.
I aim to be a Pokemon master. Quite a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Pokemon, one of the things that made that effectively caused Pokemon to double the Game Boy's lifespan, I think is partly it is music. Because if you think about Game Boy music, especially if you think about bad Game Boy music, it is, there's not a lot of space in that little cart. So themes tend to be over and over and over and over, you know, until you get to the end of the level and you're like, oh, finally. They tend to be very like cycled earworms. One thing about Pokemon is that there are so many, going back through it, there are so many little sounds and like musical tracks in that game. That when I replayed it, I was kind of like taken aback. I didn't remember some of them, but every one of them as a child kind of feels identifiable. And I think especially in the early games, and Masuda, you know, he's one of his most underrated features, I think, is as a composer. Because I don't know if there's any more composer in the history of games that's been that good at taking the limitations of handheld hardware and being able to craft him and his crew being able to craft so many fantastic themes that if you were to like hum them, like if I were like be like you'd be like, oh, the bike, right. You know? Yeah. And or like the theme for like the Pokemon Center, or the, you know, the theme for like Celadon, bum bum bada 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 bum bum bum. Like, and it's Masuda does such great work there. And it's fantastic, and it totally belies like this idea that the Game Boy that Game Boy sounds are somehow like supposed to be shitty, and it's not as like it's not as huge. It's obviously not as huge like the big orchestral scores or the big like, tracks of other like of like Nintendo 64, like stuff that would come after or whatever. But Pokemon has a really, really cool score, And I attribute that to part of its success and part of the reason why that when it came out, all of a sudden the Game Boy, which had outlasted its life or was on like death's door, people considered it. Because at that point when Pokemon came out, it was 7 years old or nearing seven years old. I want to say like 6 years and 10 months. That usually video game system usually lasts around 6 years. So this thing was archaic. And then Pokemon comes out. The Game Boy, and I read about this on Twitter today, the Game Boy, they didn't start producing Game Boy stuff until 2003.
They didn't stop.
Wow. That's 14 years for that little handheld.
Is that the record by chance?
I have no idea, but that's phenomenal.
Wow.
And part of that is due to Pokemon. But back to music, no, and like the anime is great. And, you know, when 4Kids licensed the anime, when they became Nintendo of America's licensor for Pokemon in the States, they also took away some of the Japanese things and added a lot of their much more kind of Western sounding music. Because their idea, and it's true, is the fact that Western cartoons or American cartoons are very much built around the cues. Like, kids need to get sad here, sad music. Kids need to get excited here, exciting music. Right. Kids need to feel suspense here, suspenseful music. And it, like, if you go back and watch the first Japanese episode of Pokemon, it's quiet.
Mm.
You'd be surprised about how quiet it is.
So you're talking about, like, a lot of the cues that, you know, Americans, like, if you look up the Kanto anime OST on YouTube or something, like those Team Rocket stabs. Yeah, that's very interesting. It reminds me of Kitchen Nightmares across US and UK, where they have all these cues for their American audience that are, you know, supposed to be dramatic, whereas the English, they don't have that. You just look at the...
Kitchen Nightmares in America is always like, there's a rat in the freezer.
And then in UK, of course, they omit this, I guess, because the audience doesn't necessarily play to that. You know, they don't need the indication that the rotten food is rotten.
And you can argue whether kids need it, but it's very much like keeping up with the Joneses because American kids' cartoons are loud, typically.
Sure.
So, and that's one of the reasons why. But yeah, go ahead.
That's really fascinating, though. And, you know, naturally, the theme song that would come out would stay for a long time. The 2B A Master Disc. I feel like it also has this weird, like, 1990s television score meets some pop angle. And I used to have the Pokemon 2000 CD because that was my jams back then. And you would never know any of these groups now, unless you had the Pokemon 2000 CD, but it is really curious, like how they were able to bridge chiptune, you know, 8-bit, and then create like a musical identity that worked for that generation.
Yeah. Well, the 2B Master soundtrack is kind of cool because 4Kids really wanted to get Pokemon in every aspect of a child's life.
Mm.
And one of the way was music, but kids aren't going to listen to like music if it's like, if you're the age to watch Pokemon, which is like elementary school age, probably late elementary school, you're not going to be into like cheesy songs about like lullaby sounding songs.
Sure.
And so like they're big, you know, like Ethos when creating this, like 2B A Master and like the soundtrack was like, okay, what are music that we can like, what is music like that kind of sounds like what's playing on the radio today? With like enough Pokemon in it that we can like loosely tie it back into Pokemon,
right?
So it remains Pokemon songs, but it's new. They want to create music that you'd like actually listen to, rather than like a novelty record.
Sure.
And of course, now you look back on it and then you're like, "What kind of Pokemon are you?" I'm not gonna play that at a club. I wish.
We can dream.
we can dream, but yeah, it's but it sounds like it's got like that kind of like flavor of like late 90s like R&B,
right?
And that was their main plan, is like, okay, we want to create a soundtrack that kids would actually like listen to and buy, rather than, you know, a novelty record.
Now, aside from music, one of the biggest things I remember really being into, and then I completely dropped out of this, and then now there's a huge resurgence, is the trading card game. And, mm-hmm. you know, I am so out of it with trading card games as they've seemed to like resurge into internet culture now. But I'm curious, like, your thoughts on the Pokemon card game, both because I was a collector and at the time I traveled a lot. So I would get cards from like different countries, but I never touched the competitive game until very late.
We have like a minute and 10 seconds Ooh. Left.
Okay, we're going to chat about that afterwards. Where can people find Monster Kids? I'm so sorry. I'm bad at it.
Oh, no worries. No worries. People can find Monster Kids wherever books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, your local independent bookstore, your library. You can find me on Twitter. Yeah. I'll be shilling Monster Kids, I'll Pokemon Tide Generation to catch them all on October 4th, 2022 and long, long after. But yeah, that's it. Twitter.com/DanDock, DanDock.
Awesome. Well, I'll be linking all of that in the description wherever you're listening to this, but I do appreciate you joining on.
Oh, no problem.
I'm getting my copy, hopefully right on time, and I'm very excited to dive in because like awesome. Everyone listening, Pokemon is near and dear, and I'm super, super nostalgic for that crazy time period when we were all excited for it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on, bro.
All right. Thanks for joining on. And thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been Game Grooves Uncovered Podcast, and I'll see you next time.